This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. When was the last time you pulled some live food out of the ground or off something growing in the ground? How'd you use that particular piece of food? How'd its value compare to something you might instead have pulled out of a grocery store bin? Okay, our gardening advice shows don't usually dwell on such esoteric questions, but with cooler weather on the way, some of us may soon be pining for the succulents that all summer long had been available right in the backyard. On the other hand, is gardening season really over? If you're one of those who'd like to keep it going as long as possible, you're in luck. Gardening advisors Guinevere and David are back to answer any and all questions about keeping things growing as long as possible. And our call-in lines at 888-WMRA-TALK will be open right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. On this Thursday afternoon, September 12th, we are taking calls on anything and everything to do with gardening. If due to a wrinkle in the space-time continuum, you're listening to this any other time, we'd not be able to take your call. But if right now for you is a Thursday in September, then we want to make sure you know that you can reach us by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Back with us, our favorite green thumb advisors, although we have divided them up into separate studios today. David O'Neill from Radical Roots Community Farm is here with me in the Insight Studio and way over in Charlottesville, sitting in front of a microphone at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, is Guinevere Higgins from Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest. Happy September 12th to both of you.
Hi, Tom.
Likewise. Thanks for having us back.
It sounds like you're right here in the room.
I know. I'm sorry I'm not looking at you.
Well, we'll have to work on that. But in addition to our phone number at 888-967-2825, there is another option for getting a question to Dave and Guinevere. You can post it to our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we already have a couple. The first from Jessica, who says, I'm moving into a new rental. The landlord has left open a small space, about 2 feet by 4 feet, where he said it would be okay to plant a garden. Is there anything I can get started this time of year, or do I need to wait until spring? What a great question to start us off. Guinevere, you want to start?
Sure. Well, given that Jessica's got a 2 foot by 4 foot space to work with, it's small, but I would say, you know, it'll wow Jessica with how much food she can grow in that space. The first thing she's going to want to do, if she can get right to it, is thinking about amending the existing soil, removing any sod or anything that's, you know, currently growing there, any woody mulch maybe that's in there, and adding a good bit of compost, just to try to bring her soil up to snuff and make sure it's got good water holding capacity and lots of beneficial microorganisms and some nutrients in there. If she can get that all done in the next week or so, I'd say go ahead and plant it with a fall garden, which includes, you know, crops like lettuce and kale and Swiss chard and spinach and beets and all kinds of great stuff. Now, if Jessica does not have quite enough time to get all that done in the next few weeks, then I'd say go ahead and get the soil prepped, and then she'll just be ready to go, you know, in early spring next year when it comes time to plant again.
Yeah, that sounds great. There's a ton of things that you still have time to plant right now, and a lot of those things are hardy fall winter greens, just like whenever mentioned. There's also garlic that's a fall planted crop. It grows over the winter, and then it's harvested in late spring, early summer. One thing we're planting on our farm right now when we're done with our garden beds is cover crop. And cover crop is any crop that's not a harvest crop, but it's a crop grown to actually improve the soil by adding organic matter to the soil or by adding nitrogen to the soil. So some of the cover crops we use and we're planting this time of the year are a winter rye combined with Austrian winter pea. So the rye is organic matter and the pea provides nitrogen to the soil. So that's a great thing to do. For any garden bed that is kind of done producing for the season, we can pull out the plant material or incorporate the crop residue and then get the cover crop seeded and growing.
Jessica, thanks for starting off with starting us off with such a terrific question. We'll get to some of these other Facebook queries in a moment, but we got some calls coming in, so let's go next to Elkton. Lamar, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for David O'Neill and or Guinevere Higgins, please.
Yes, in planning, whether it's an early, late crop, do you use the Farmer's Almanac to go by to make sure that you're getting your seeds or plants in the ground at the right time?
I don't use the Farmer's Almanac, but I do really pay attention to the season we're having. For example, this season it's been a really wet summer, and we're kind of going into a dry fall. It's been dry here for the past week or so. So we've gone back to irrigating all those tender transplants of those fall greens that we've gotten in the garden beds the past couple weeks. Our lettuces and spinach, we've been irrigating them to help them get established. I pay particular attention to our average first frost date, and that's the point of the season that I work backwards from to do all the fall and winter garden planning. So here in the Shenandoah Valley, I usually use the date of October 10th as our average first frost. So we're only a month away from that. And a good rule is to have our winter crops 75 to 90% mature by that first frost date. So working backwards, we're 4 weeks away from that first frost date, and I can put in a three-week-old lettuce transplant today, and in 4 weeks' time, that first frost date, it'll be close to mature. And that's kind of one method of planning, is to use that first frost date.
Guinevere, is the average first frost date any different in your part of the state, in Charlottesville?
It is. It's a little later than the valley over here on this side of the Blue Ridge. So we usually go by, you know, it depends too. I mean, even within a region, the first frost date or last frost date can differ by quite a bit. So, you know, in low-lying areas like Scottsville, you know, the first frost date might be quite a bit earlier than in a place like, you know, downtown Charlottesville, which tends to be a little warmer.
And I would imagine for our listeners in Southside around Farmville, it's probably later still. Is there an easy way for somebody to figure out what the first frost date is for wherever they are located?
You know, Cooperative Extension has that information. I mean, if you Googled, you know, first frost date with your, you know, with your region or your county, I'm sure you'd come up with the information pretty quickly. But we in Charlottesville, we kind of, you know, it, again, it differs by the season, and the seasons change quite dramatically. But, you know, late October, sometimes as late as, you know, mid-November, sometimes it's when we see our first frost. So it just depends. But like Dave said, you know, better to err on the side of caution. There's nothing wrong with having those plants be a little more mature than they otherwise would be if you got an early frost. So go ahead and get them in the ground.
Lamar, I'm curious, do you use the Farmer's Almanac?
I grew up, I'm not from this area. I'm originally from Mississippi, and my dad religiously planted by the almanac to make sure that he never put anything in the ground when the lady had the flowers in her hand, as he termed that bloom day. And a lot of people in this area don't, but I was just curious because I do tend to look at it to see if, you know, if it's a good day for putting things in the ground or not. I guess it's just the way I grew up.
And has it been working for you? Sounds like it worked for your dad.
Yes, and I'll say that it does work, but I wanted professional opinion to see where you come from. And I like that idea about finding out when the frost is, or mm-hmm. potential frost, and going backwards to make sure that, because I have some tomato plants that are blooming and have little tomatoes on them already. They were voluntarily when they came up. So I was just curious to know if I would be able to get anything before the first frost or not.
You might. It's still a long ways away. And like Guinevere was saying, it's just an average date. It could be a lot later, just like we learned in the spring. Our average frost date in the spring is May 10th, and our farm lost 500 tomato plants to frost on May 22nd. So we had a pretty late last frost date in the spring. So there's a lot of variability in that. The great thing about the fall garden is that the crops will hold. The lettuce doesn't bolt or want to go to seed and get bitter so quickly like it does in the hot summer. It really holds, especially with a little bit of cover or protection. All our fall hardy greens can hold all winter. And so just getting them in the ground early enough this time of year so that they're pretty established before it gets real cold is the main technique.
Lamar, I just love the idea that you think of David and Guinevere as professionals, and I'm going to borrow that term.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks so much. So we will say that professional organic gardener Guinevere Higgins, as well as professional organic farmer Dave O'Neill, are our guests.
That's right.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our call-in phone number, easy to remember, as 888-WMRA-TALK. We're going next to Charlottesville. Tom, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, hi. I'm calling in behalf of my desperate trees. We had gotten an infestation of the Japanese beetles, which I'm sure is pretty popular in Charlottesville and around the surrounding counties. But my question is, if I was to treat trees, soil, and so on, and my neighbors do not, am I still going to get them next year or going to have issues with that?
The best thing you can hope for, Tom, I think, is for a really, really cold winter. And that'll help kill off any overwintering critters in the soil. You know, do be careful as far as how you're planning to treat your trees. And, you know, I'm not aware off the top of my head of a way of treating trees organically for Japanese beetles. You know, so do kind of keep in mind as far as the impact that treating those trees might have on, you know, your landscape, your pets, your kids, that kind of thing. Dave?
Yeah, they definitely move about. They're pretty freely. There are Japanese beetle traps, and I've heard that the best place to put those are on your neighbor's property. Because, you know, it attracts them from a wide area. And so I think they're pretty mobile. The Japanese beetles are pretty mobile. You know, other techniques are getting some kind of other predator, like chickens, tend to do a pretty good job with Japanese beetles. Mm-hmm. At least in the vegetable garden.
And you get eggs out of it. Or I guess if you have a rooster, you get eggs out of it.
You get eggs either way,
well,
Tom.
You get eggs.
Do you
no
really?
Let me tell you how things work.
Number one misconception about chickens.
Is that you have to have a rooster around for them to be
right.
making eggs.
If you want baby chickens, then yes, you need a rooster. But if you just want eggs, the hens make the eggs no matter what. Just like the human hens make the eggs no matter what.
They do. How about that? Tom, thanks so much for your call. Have we helped at all before we got off into birds and bee type information?
No, guys. Thanks so much. I appreciate the help.
Thank you. Let's
Good
go
luck.
Next to Stanton. This is Sarah. Sarah, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please, for Guinevere Higgins and Dave O'Neill.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this summer, we experimented with edible landscaping in our front yard, and it worked out really well. It was beautiful, and we had lots of vegetables all summer. My concern is that that's all going to die, and it's going to look really barren and ugly. And we have people on our street trying to sell their house, and we don't want to be the weird neighbors with the ugly, barren garden in our front yard. So I'm wondering about, I don't know, maybe ground cover or just something I could put in those in the garden to winter over that will look nice, but aren't going to completely deplete the soil, because I'd really like to do this again next spring.
Great. Well, you are a really conscientious neighbor. That's awfully thoughtful of you. I would say go ahead and plant the cover crop that Dave recommended, because the winter rye and the Austrian winter peas look gorgeous over the winter. They're bright green. I mean, they look like the nicest, softest, most verdant, you know, lush lawn you can imagine. So that's attractive. Garlic,
we're about to
I think,
hit
is
to,
also attractive.
We're about to hit to the break. So I'm sure that in addition to the fact that you've got more Guinevere, Dave probably has some too. So Sarah, will you hang on? And
sure.
We'll be back
sure.
in just a bit more than 1 minute. Oh, we don't have the music. Yes. All right. Let me see. Gardening specialist David O'Neill. Maybe we can get him to sing. Is co-owner of the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keezeltown. Gardening specialist Guinevere Higgins is co-founder of the Charlottesville-based garden consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We still got Sarah on the line. Maybe we get Sarah to sing if you give a really great answer to her question. You want to sort of, for anybody who's just joined in since the break, summarize what Sarah's question was
sure.
about, David?
Sure. We heard from Sarah. She had a wonderful and abundant edible landscaping front yard garden. And she must have heard the show in the springtime because that's what we were talking about and recommending.
Actually,
and
you were the
I
one.
Well,
yes,
it
right.
might have
Go
been
ahead.
Me personally.
Feature chest.
But so we heard from Sarah about how great her garden was, but she's concerned because now it's fall and things are turning brown and drying out, and her neighbor's trying to sell, and she doesn't want her
property to bring down the property value for her neighbor. What a nice lady Sarah is.
Yes.
Maybe she will sing for us.
So, but it's all a state of mind because really when I see food gardens, I always think of increased property values just because of the abundance and the resilience that a food garden implies. I love seeing food gardens, edible landscaping in the front yard. So no reason to hide them in the back. Bring them out to the front, especially if that's where the only sun is. We need full sun for a lot of our food plants, especially our annual garden. And then what do we do with them in the fall? How do we make them look nice? Two choices. We can either incorporate crop residue or pull out old brown dead plants and put them in the compost pile. And then we can cover crop as we were talking about, or we can do a deep, thick mulch, some kind of organic matter like straw or wood chips, something to cover the soil for the winter, might make it look a little tighter than just bare soil with dead plants in it. And then Guinevere had also mentioned garlic. Garlic is planted this time of year, anytime now till November, and will typically grow up through a mulch. Nice, neat rows of garlic planted at tight spacing would also look like a beautiful, edible front yard landscape, too.
I don't know about you, Sarah, but I'm just getting hungry listening to Guinevere.
Yeah, I'm pretty hungry.
and I'm curious what kinds of stuff you were growing on your lawn.
I had two types of tomatoes. I had zucchini and cucumber and bell peppers. I had pretty much every herb you can think of. I did spinach and lettuce and kale. I had a lot. It was pretty successful.
And can you describe your neighborhood for us? You're in Stanton.
I'm in Stanton. I'm right near Mary Baldwin College, just right on top of the hill by the college. So
it isn't like you're isolated off in the woods or something. You got
no.
Lots
I'm
of...
in a I'm in a historic neighborhood right in the middle of the downtown area. So my neighbors are 3 yards away from me on either side.
So we're all going to want to come and see your yard next year.
I'll send you a picture.
You could also put some fall mums on the corner and call it good.
Oh, mums! Yeah.
Absolutely. But good for you, Sarah, for getting some productivity happening in your front yard and starting to change the aesthetic paradigm of the front yard in America.
And
well,
making
you
us,
your part.
I'm sorry,
you
go ahead.
You inspired me this spring or last spring to do it. So.
All right.
Awesome.
It was
she
you,
heard
David.
It.
Wow.
She heard it.
Nice work, Dave.
Hey.
Sarah, thank you so very much for calling us.
Thank you. Have a good night.
So if you there on the other side of your radio have a question, issue, concern, or even a hard-won success story that relates to gardening and you'd like to share, our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. Well, I guess that's not really a number. That's a memory tool. The number's 888-967-2825. Our Facebook address is pretty easy to remember. We're listed on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight if you want to post there to us. And that's what Alexandra did. And she says, my best friend and roommate brought some herbs in jars with her when she moved to Virginia from Texas about a month ago. Most of them are thriving on our bedroom windowsill, but the lemon balm died a slow, painful death. When she removed it from the jar, we saw that the cutting had never grown any roots. Is there a reason why the other plants, peppermint, oregano, rosemary, and thyme, took root and did well, but lemon balm did not? David?
There could be lots of reasons. First of all, I could commend her on a great move from the nation of Texas to the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Well, that's her roommate.
Oh, her roommate. So here she is in a great gardening state where all those culinary herbs can grow wonderfully for many months of the year. They're all perennial, and they'll come back in the spring when they're established. These sounds like maybe they were small cuttings, and most of them had roots except the lemon balm. And that's a little bit curious because lemon balm typically roots itself quite easily without any assistance from a gardener. I mean, it will jump out of a pot and send a little runner down and root where it lands. So lemon balm is an easy one to root. The other ones are fairly hardy culinary herbs as well. I can't think of any specific reason, although I would encourage her to try again. And if she's doing a cutting from an existing lemon balm, one trick that does help is to use willow tea or willow water. Willow has lots of different hormones naturally in the plant that help it root. And if you make a watery extraction of the branches, then it can help other plants root. So
willow tea made from the bark of a willow tree?
Mm-hmm. The bark or the twigs or the leaves basically just chopped up and soaked in a bucket of water overnight, and then using that tea to help root the cutting.
Guinevere, do I recall hearing from you in the past that lemon balm is something that most people actually have trouble with because it grows so fast it kind of like takes over?
It can be a little problematic in the garden. So if you plant it out in your garden, just put it in a place where you can either let it take over or be sure to cut it back before it goes to flower and set seed. Otherwise, you will have little itty bitty lemon balm seedlings everywhere you go. So yeah, just make sure you kind of keep it contained. But it's a lovely plant. It smells amazing. You can chop it up, put it in your salad, or stick a sprig in your iced tea. You can make a tea out of it. But you know, the other thing too is it's not going extinct. So it's easy to find. You can pick it up at the nursery or take a cutting from a friend who's got an established plant.
Alexandra, I don't know how you are interpreting what you're hearing, but that was a great question, and my interpretation is it's a mystery. The experts can't tell you exactly why this happened. They wouldn't have expected it to happen, but it certainly, they are saying, is worth trying again. Gang, is that a fair interpretation?
I think so.
Exactly.
Okay, so on Facebook from Terry, a follow-up to a previous call from Sarah, Terry wondering if there is a no-mow type of lawn cover.
Mm. Mm. My recommendation would be clover, white clover. It grows fairly low. I don't know if I could go as far as to say it's no-mow, like ever. But if you don't mind sort of a bushier, thicker lawn, and it doesn't grow blades of grass. It grows, of course, just like four-leaf clovers or, clover leaves that we're used to seeing in a park or they occur naturally in the lawn anyway. But clover is wonderful because it's low-growing. It grows quickly. It's fairly drought-tolerant. It's a legume, so it adds nitrogen to the soil, so it'll actually help build up the soil in your lawn if that's something that's important to you. It also, when it's allowed to flower, is wonderful forage for bees. So you'll be doing the bees a big favor by turning your dead, dormant Bermuda grass lawn into a nice, lush clover lawn. And I think, personally, that clover is the nicest, most lush, wonderful, verdant lawn to walk through and to lie on. So it'll really encourage you to get outside in your bare feet and go play on your grass. So I would do clover.
I think that's a good suggestion, and I could also clarify when I was recommending the cover crop for Sarah's garden that it does get tall. It'll grow slowly through the winter consistently and stay green, but in about March when we get those first kind of warm days, it'll shoot up, and by April 1st it might be 4, 5, even 6 feet tall.
And oh, that'll help sell our neighbor's property if it's still.
It's only for a few weeks, and it does all go back down into the garden. What we do is just mow it down, usually the 1st of April, and then incorporate that back into the soil to feed the soil. So it does get tall, but it's just for a couple weeks, and it is a good soil feed. And if she's looking for, I think white clover is great. But typically in an annual garden setting, we tend to use a crimson clover, which is which is red when it blooms, it's a little bit faster to grow, and the seed's not quite as expensive.
So to you listening in, I'm curious, has there been something in your garden in years past that just continues to baffle you? Some kind of pest, perhaps, that won't take your invitation to dine elsewhere? Some kind of challenge with too much sun or too little? Something about the soil where you are, or something completely different? If you'd like to talk to Guinevere Higgins and Dave O'Neill and see if they can come up with some help for you, we'd be glad to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Carolyn on Facebook has this post. I want to garden with native beneficial plants, most specifically with milkweed. My neighbor has some milkweed plants that have seeds on them right now. Should I plant the seeds in my yard or transplant one of her plants? Any suggestions on how to best grow milkweed are much appreciated. Guinevere, let's start with you on that.
Okay. Well, milkweed is a wonderful native plant to garden with. There's a couple different varieties, and folks are probably familiar with seeing the sort of the common milkweed. It's a little taller. It tends to populate in like farm fields and pastures. It's got those big puffy flowers and makes those really fun seed pods that are really fun to disperse into the wind. They're really silky. And then there's a tuberous milkweed, which is it's lower growing. It's got beautiful orange flowers. It's used oftentimes as an ornamental because it's so pretty, but it is also a native, and it's wonderful for native pollinators and beneficial insects. So my recommendation, depending on which type of milkweed that Carolyn would like to see in her own garden, tuberous milkweed or Asclepias tuberosa is a little more
I'm sorry, what did you say?
The Latin is Asclepias tuberosa.
You guys just show off all the time.
I know, it's terrible.
Go ahead.
That one's a little more challenging to get established from seed. So I'd say if that's the one she's looking for, and that's the beautiful, you know, purple flowers, orange flowers, low growing, she might be better off trying to transplant that. If it is the common milkweed, you know, the taller one with the big, you know, less showy flowers, but those big puffball flowers, because they create so much seed, I'd say give it a shot and try, try spreading some of those seeds around in your garden. Otherwise, transplanting is good, but I would recommend waiting a little while. Wait till the plants go dormant, cut them back, dig them up, stick them in the ground. So maybe sometime October, November, water them well, kind of baby them for the winter, give them some mulch, and then hopefully they'll come back in the spring.
That sounds great. And the monarchs are specifically tied to the milkweeds. That's one of their main foods all the way up when they're migrating to Mexico. So having lots of milkweed around is great. I know on my farm, the kids go out and collect them and spread them and look for all the monarch chrysalises this time of year.
And you're helping the butterfly population.
Yeah, it's fun.
Has been
challenged. In Charlottesville, we've got Richard calling in. Richard, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment for Guinevere Higgins and or Dave O'Neill, please.
Yeah, my question is, I've turned to monocropping due to lack of time, and I've got a great sweet potato crop going, and I would love to harvest the sweet potatoes and put in garlic, and then somehow, as soon as the garlic is finished, go back into sweet potatoes. And I'm a little concerned about the soil types and, of course, harvest times, but soil types, the sweet potatoes seem to like a sandy soil, and I am concerned that if I put too much organic matter in for the garlic, that the sweet potatoes won't succeed.
Hmm. That's a good question. So in my experience with sweet potatoes, they tend to be, like sandy soil. If you've got sandy soil, it's great to grow sweet potatoes. But my experience has been that they also do fine in beds with high organic matter. That's where I actually planted my own sweet potatoes this year. It was in a bed that had been freshly amended with lots of compost. And they seem to be doing just fine. I haven't dug them yet. It's a little early still for when I planted them. But I would say, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about it. What I would worry about, though, is, I mean, it's good you've got sort of two rotations going there, but just being aware of, you know, having only two rotations and with no opportunity to, you know, to plant a cover crop in between, just making sure that you're replenishing your soil on a regular basis so that you're not drawing down too many of the nutrients that sweet potatoes rely on and that the garlic relies on. So, you know, so maybe taking a soil test and just kind of making sure you know what you've got, or at the very least, just making sure you're putting down good compost right now in preparation for that garlic.
Want to remind us how to do a soil test, Guinevere?
Sure. A soil test is easy. You can do one through Virginia Tech. I do the one through UMass Amherst, actually, up in Massachusetts, only because they also test for lead as part of the sort of routine soil analysis. So I just like to know whether or not we got any lead issues to deal with. But it's pretty simple. What you're looking to do is, you know, depending on the area you're trying to take an accurate soil sample from, you know, if it's one bed, take a couple different samples from various places in that bed. What you're trying to do is take a composite sample. So you'll take your soil sample. You want to dig down about 6 or 8 inches, sort of pretend like you're the root zone of a plant, you know, and think about how far down you'd need to go if you were that plant, if you're a carrot or a tomato. You know, so a good 6 to 8 inches, dig up a shovel full of soil, put it in a bucket, and then go elsewhere in your bed or in your garden, get that nice composite sample, mix it together in that bucket, and then I usually fill up, you know, those little Ziploc bags, the littlest ones they make, little snack bags. Usually one of those filled up is ample. And then send it off. And, you know, it's only about $10 to have your soil tested. It's a good investment. Helps you kind of connect with, you know, both what, you know, what's in your soil and then what can you do organically to improve it.
Does that sound like it's on target for you, Richard?
It does. I wonder if the harvest dates coincide with each other so that you could get a crop out, you know, a sweet potato out. And a garlic in, and then a garlic out, and then a sweet potato in. And I know that when you grow garlic, that after you plant them, you can just heap them with, you know, composting type material. So that really feeds the garden at that juncture, I would think.
You're nodding your head, David.
Oh, I'm in agreement. I think those two crops can work well together. Garlic is highly adaptable. It can create a land race very fast, which is just in a couple generations of growing your own saved seed garlic in the same soil.
Did you say a land race?
Mm-hmm. It's not a separate variety, but it's an adaptation of the garlic to the soil that it's growing in. So if you do careful selection of your own seed stock, then you can improve that seed and your own garlic through two or three plantings of it.
Richard, thanks so much for your question. And now when we get back from the break, I'm really going to have to find out what a land race is. I realize most everybody listening is probably smart enough that they already know. But just in case you there want to know too, please stay tuned for that and a whole bunch more gardening stuff coming up in a bit more than 1 minute. Most any kind of garden, I guess, can help you feel free. Dusty Springfield, back from 1968. That was probably before our guests were born.
That is. I like the magic
possibly,
garden.
Yes.
Professional organic farmer Dave O'Neill, professional organic gardener Guinevere Higgins, our guests. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, the easy way to remember it. Next to Culpepper, Barbara, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call. This is our first year in Culpeper. We've always had very good luck gardening in the past. but we just happened to have moved into the stink bug epicenter of Virginia. And they literally destroyed our entire garden. Tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, melons, even zucchini. And we were wondering, what can we treat the garden or the soil with next year to prevent this and still protect our very large, magnificent dog who does wander around the yard?
Wow, that sounds tough. I mean,
I think that's a million-dollar question right there.
Yeah, stink bugs are new, and there's a lot of research going on, and the gist of it is they don't know much yet.
Good.
so you're pioneering this, and one thing I would like you to try next year is to grow some of your plants under floating row cover, which is a white spunbound poly sheet. You can get it in different lengths and widths, and it basically acts as an exclusion method where you're hiding the crop from the pest. We use a lot of it on our farm. We buy it in 1,000-foot lengths and cover crops as different as arugula and broccoli in the brassica family, all the way to winter squash and summer squash, as well as even pepper plants when they're young. Many of our crops, the fruiting crops, we take the floating row cover off when they're in flower to get pollination inside, because it does such a good job of excluding any kind of insect. It would potentially exclude pollinators from the flower. But if you can get the plant up till its full expression, till it's mature enough to make flowers, often it can produce for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, even if it has pest pressure at that point. So that would be my go-to strategy. But it sounds like you got eaten out of house and home.
Oh, we did. I mean, they even destroyed the zucchini, and I didn't think anything could destroy a zucchini.
Sounds like squash bugs. They're all squash bugs, leaf-footed bugs, stink bugs are all in the same family, and they look a lot alike, but they tend to feed to sort of differentiate a little bit, and the squash bugs will absolutely decimate anything in that family. It's awful.
Okay.
Barbara, if it's of any help to you, we've had some of the researchers who actually are leading some of the national research based out of Virginia on stink bug problems on this show a couple of times over the past couple of years. And much of that work is being done out of Virginia Tech. So if you were to Google Virginia Tech research and stink bug, you'd probably come up with some stuff. And as David was saying, much of what they're finding so far is that they're in process of trying to figure out how to deal with this, because you can imagine from your experience, it's really a big threat to agriculture, and that means not just millions, but hundreds of millions, even potentially billions of dollars of damage to our economy.
Exactly. I mean, the exterminator takes care of them around the house, but I don't want to exterminate my garden, you know.
And you don't want to put your pets at risk. That's
exactly
certainly understandable. A couple of things that I can recall from when the scientists who study this have been on that might be useful to you. One is that, as you probably noticed, the stink bugs at night are attracted to light. One of the more interesting things that they've worked with, primarily indoors, but there's no reason why it couldn't work outdoors if it's really dark, is getting a large pan, like a turkey baster pan, and putting some mirrored surface in the bottom of it, you know, maybe just an actual mirror, and then filling it up maybe halfway with soapy water and fixing a light above that pan so that in the dark the light shines into the pan and is reflected upward, and stink bugs commit suicide by the hundreds in these pans in the experiments that they've been doing, because they're attracted to the light and they get trapped in the soapy water. The other thing is, the reason that we're having such trouble with them is that they're not native to the U.S. There are stink bugs that are native to the U.S. that we don't have any problems with, but this brown marmorated bug is the one that's the invader, and it came in from somewhere in Asia, probably from China. And in that part of the world, there's a little tiny wasp. I understand that one of the scientists called it a comma wasp. It's almost so, the size of a comma, almost so small you can't see it. And it attacks the stink bug's eggs. And so in a research center belonging to the USDA in New Jersey, in a highly confined area, they've been experimenting with this little wasp to see if it would be safe to eventually release it in the U.S. But in the meantime, they've been monitoring other potential predators for the stink bugs, and they found over the past couple of years that there are birds and even chickens that used to not eat them that now are developing a taste for them. So maybe all those things are reasons for hope.
And you know what? In the spring, in the early spring, sometimes you can get a hold of praying mantis eggs. And I've seen personally praying mantises just going to town on a stink bug. So, you know, it's one way. If you can encourage praying mantises in your garden, it's another reason not to bomb anywhere on your property,
right?
Because you do want to make sure that you're encouraging the growth and the proliferation of beneficial insects. You know, those bombs tend to be pretty nonspecific. So if you can encourage the growth of praying mantises, you may find that they will help make a dent in your stink bug population.
Barbara, we feel your pain, and it's something I think we can all share your concern. Good luck next year.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. Organic gardening advisor and operator of the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keesletown, Dave O'Neill, is one of our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. Also with us, another organic gardening specialist, Guinevere Higgins. She runs Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, a gardening consulting firm based in Charlottesville. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. And Guinevere, you had a kind of announcement of something going on you wanted to make sure people knew about.
I did. So folks who've listened into the program before know I've been involved with a city schoolyard garden, and that's Charlottesville's educational garden program here in Charlottesville City Schools to get kids outside with their hands in the dirt. And there's an event coming up that City Schoolyard Garden is putting on at all the elementary schools in Charlottesville that all have brand new gardens. They're going to do a garden tour on Saturday, September 21st. So if you've been curious at all about what's happening at these schools and you want to see the gardens in action, meet the garden coordinators, some of the folks who've been working to get kids outdoors and get their hands in the dirt, Saturday, September 21st is going to be your chance to do that. The tour runs from 9 to 1, and it's sort of self-guided, so you can show up at these schools. And there's more information on the City Schoolyard Garden website, as far as specific times and, you know, which schools will be participating. So you can check that out at cityschoolyardgarden.org. But I encourage folks to learn about what's happening in the city schools with kids gardening. It's really awesome.
Thanks so much. And for you there listening, we do have a couple more minutes to fit in calls. If you were to get to your phone right now and dial us in at 888-967-2825, we could probably get you in. Phone number is easy to remember, is 888-WMRA. Talk, and all of a sudden, all of our lines are open. So this is your chance. On Facebook, we do have this from Mike, who says, I have discovered a new species of insect. Well, just kidding, but I've never seen these things before. On an evergreen in my backyard, these little pods have been growing. From a distance, they look just like a clump of dead brown needles hanging from the tree. But when I pull them off, I can tell that it's really something like a chrysalis with a little worm thing inside. Do you have any idea what these things are? Is it possible they're showing up for the first time because we've had so much rain this year?
That's a stumper. I'm not sure what that insect is. Although I would take this as an opportunity to tell folks that really what belongs on every gardener's bookshelf is a really high quality guide to insects, so that you can identify sort of what is friend and what is foe in the garden. And you'll learn a lot there. It's really fascinating. And the book that I like is Insects of North America by Whitney Cranshaw. It's a thick, thick book. If your short child is in need of a booster seat, it's a good book to use. But it's got wonderful color photographs and great reference to both the beneficial insects and to the insects that can be damaging. It's easy to find exactly which insect you're trying to identify. And I really think it belongs. If you're interested in gardening, prepare to get interested in bugs.
And the second part of his question, is it the first time that they're showing up? That's possible, but probably not so likely, although insect populations really do surge and pulse with the seasons.
But you don't know what he's talking about either.
I don't know specifically from that description which insects he's talking about. But just on our farm, we see populations really just swell and are different from season to season. We've seen a lot of saddleback caterpillars this fall that kind of sting. They're real bright and, you know, have horns all over them.
Okay, something else to look out for. We've got time for one more call, I think, and this is from Lyndhurst. Patrick, thanks for joining us. Your question, your comment, please.
Hi, I'm wondering how I can get rid of the cabbage moth worms. They're eating my broccoli rabe and my kale.
Yes, they are awful. So Dave mentioned earlier the floating row cover, and that's a great exclusion method for keeping the cabbage moths from laying eggs on your brassicas, because we call them cabbage moths and cabbage worms, but they really like to eat anything in the brassica family. So your kale, your collards, your arugula, and certainly your cabbage and your broccoli. So try to keep them off if you can. But before you put your row cover on, make sure you've gone through really with a fine tooth comb and you've picked off all those caterpillars, because otherwise you're just protecting them there under the row cover for them to do their dirty work. So put up a barrier.
If they're already there?
I would say if you've gotten those plants in the ground and you've seen the moths, then yes, they're already there. The next thing you want to look for, you want to look for, certainly for the worms, but then also look for the eggs. And typically they're on the underside of the leaves. They're very, very small, but they're a pale yellow color. So they stand out in contrast to the leaf. So they're fairly actually easy to see. And go ahead and smush any eggs you see. It's really easy to do with your fingers. Pretty painless. And that will help a lot as well.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to keep pinching them off as I see them, because they're growing by the hour. All right.
They really do grow fast. Good luck.
We're almost out of time, but we may have a mystery solver on the line with us from Bridgewater. Dick, thanks for calling in.
Hey, the answer to that, the needles around the worm, those are bagworms. I've seen them many times, and sometimes they'll just populate a whole tree. There'll be hundreds of them.
Are they harmful to the tree?
They can if they get to be hundreds of them. You can just pick them off by hand. You need to try to get them all off. And there are some chemicals that you can use that you mix up and put in the soil. That is, apply to the roots. They are systemic chemicals, and the tree sucks them up, and that will eliminate them too.
Bagworms. I had never heard of such a thing.
Oh yeah, they're fairly common. I think rain also helps them.
Well, Dick, thanks so much for helping us solve that mystery. Before we run out of time, David O'Neill, we have a couple of different pictures on our different Facebook pages from times that you have been here. You're with Guinevere, and she looks pretty much the same, although one's sort of a wintry outfit and one's sort of a summery outfit. But you look different.
Ah.
One, you've got a real thick beard. The other one, you're almost clean shaven. If somebody wants to see which of those pictures looks more like you, they can actually find out this Saturday or for several future Saturdays.
That's right. They can come and see me at the Charlottesville City Market. Every Saturday, we're selling over 40 different vegetables and garden-related great things to eat. That's all certified organic at the City Market in Charlottesville from 7 a.m. till noon. That's downtown, a block off the City Mall, the downtown mall between 2nd and Water Street. And Radical Roots Farm is also at the Harrisonburg Farmers Market every Saturday from 7 till 1, and that's at the Turner Pavilion in between Liberty and North Main Streets.
Okay, so I know that you're a magic guy, but how do you get to be in Charlottesville and in Harrisonburg during the same hours?
I haven't figured that out yet, but I get to take part of the crew over to the Charlottesville Market, and then our farm manager and part of the crew sets up at the Harrisonburg Market. So we cover both markets. They're both on Saturday morning. I only get to be at one.
We got 30 seconds left. Guinevere, David said something before about some sort of race something that I didn't understand. Do you remember? Can you explain that to me?
A land race. So it's sort of a Garlic is a great example of a land race because essentially what happens is over time, it's easy to propagate garlic year to year, garlic that you've grown yourself and that's readily adapted to your own garden. And so a land race is just sort of a readily adapted variety of a plant that's well suited for the place in which it's growing.
And it's called that because it races across the soil?
Why it's called that, I'm not sure. But landrace corn, I mean, you know, landrace corn is sort of like the proto corn, the original corn.
I get educated so much whenever you guys are around. I hope you listening do as well. Our guests have been Guinevere Higgins, professional gardening advisor and owner of the Charlottesville-based consulting firm Blue Ridge Backyard Harvest, as well as Dave O'Neill, organic farming specialist and co-owner of the Radical Roots Community Farm in Keesletown. Thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thanks, Tom. It was a lot of fun.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight online at WMRA.org. Then clicking on programs and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find more information about both of our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.